This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. We are Community Amplified.
We cannot be caught flat-footed while we are watching the President of the United States engage in political redlining and gutting decades of progress that generations before us fought for.
Governor Wes Moore signs Maryland's redistricting amendment. I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, Maryland's long redistricting journey, and we find out what a bevy of new announcements mean for the Preakness, the state's signature horse race. And the concert of the summer comes to Baltimore.
I did not expect them to come to my home state, which made me really, like, shocked and also excited at the same time.
K-pop boy band BTS. That's all coming up on WYPR's News Roundup. Good afternoon and welcome to WYPR's News Roundup. We're Community Amplified, Baltimore Public Media 88.1 WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, and WYPO Ocean City at 106.9. Every single one of those places impacted by what the Maryland General Assembly did this week, and that's what we're going to lead the show off with our reporter Sarah Petrowich. Then we're going to talk about the shakeup in the world of thoroughbred racing and the new schedule for Maryland's entry in the Triple Crown, the Preakness. Then our own Frederick County reporter Nathaniel Miller joins us to discuss why a citizen-led effort to put the fight over data centers in Frederick County before voters this fall failed. Later, we pass the mic to Bree Reed, a Baltimore-based writer who discusses the power of reading. And we'll also be talking about Korean popular music ahead of BTS's performance in Baltimore next week. But first, the General Assembly met this week in Annapolis to take up redistricting. WIPR's State House and State Politics reporter Sarah Petrowich was there gavel to gavel. She joins me now in studio. Welcome back to the show, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So listeners might remember that there was a push for congressional district redistricting already in Maryland earlier this year. Why are we here again? And then what happened this week?
Right. So we got to take this back to last summer. That's when President Donald Trump called on Texas to redraw its congressional map to pick up some seats for Republicans in the U.S. House. And this launched a nationwide redistricting arms race where Democratic states and Republican states have been fighting to try and redraw their maps to favor their party. And Governor Wes Moore tried to enter this fight. He constituted a redistricting advisory commission that ultimately recommended an 8-0 map to the General Assembly to pass. An 8-0 map refers to a map that would bring 8 Democrats to Congress on Maryland's behalf. Currently, there's a split of 7-1 with 1 Republican. The House passed that map in February, but Ferguson blocked it due to legal concerns. But Ferguson says the ground has shifted since the Federal Voting Rights Act decision in April, which gutted key provisions that were protecting black voting power in the South. He's arguing that making this constitutional change really didn't become urgent until now.
We had talked after 2022 about dealing with this issue ahead of 2030. And so this had been something that had been kind of in contemplation for a while. Now, obviously, because of what happened in Texas and now the Supreme Court case and follow-on states who have eliminated majority-minority districts in the South in particular, it became more relevant. And this is the time we had to act to make sure that we were in a position of strength no matter where we are moving forward, not a position of weakness.
Now, you broke the story earlier this summer that Maryland lawmakers were coming back for the special session that ended up being this week to discuss these changes. So what was on the table for lawmakers as they returned to Annapolis?
Right. So something key to know here is there was no map this special session. So that 8-0 map that I referred to previously was not on the table. This is just a constitutional amendment that addresses a 2022 legal ruling from Judge Lynn Battaglia. So for listeners, if you ever hear the Battaglia decision, that's what this is referring to. And in that case, Democratic lawmakers tried to pass an 8-0 map back in 2020. Battaglia ruled that to be partisan gerrymandering and that it's illegal under the Maryland Constitution. But Bill Ferguson and House Speaker Jocelyn Pena-Melnick argue Battaglia made a mistake in that ruling and that the state constitution was never supposed to govern how congressional maps were drawn, only state legislative districts, which are what we use when electing members of the General Assembly.
So after a combined 11 hours of debate this week, the constitutional amendment was passed by the General Assembly. Now, what will voters see on their ballot this coming November? What are they going to decide?
Right. So let's talk about the exact ballot language that voters are actually going to see and what it means if voters vote yes. So this amendment clarifies that certain standards in the Maryland Constitution apply only to districts used to elect members of the General Assembly. So those standards are things like making sure districts are compact and contiguous, consist of adjoining territory, respect political subdivisions, things like that. This constitutional amendment ensures that those guidelines only apply to legislative districts, not congressional districts. So if voters vote yes on that, that means that those maps, the congressional maps, are only subject to federal law and the U.S. Constitution. So this, in a sense, would open the door up for partisan gerrymandering for congressional maps in Maryland. That's if you vote yes on the amendment. The other thing it would do is give original jurisdiction to the Supreme Court over redistricting cases. This is a little bit in the legal weeds
That's
of it.
The state Supreme Court.
Exactly. Thank you. The state Supreme Court of Maryland. So essentially, if you as a voter feel disenfranchised by a map for partisan gerrymandering, you could sue, but the General Assembly could say, wait, let's take this directly to the Maryland Supreme Court to speed up the legal process. But concerns have been raised about what that could really mean for someone trying to sue over a map. If you bring it to the state Supreme Court, there's a good chance that they will tell you you actually need to file in federal court, and this could kind of create an endless loop of trying to actually get some standing for your case. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Now, again, as Sarah said earlier, the special session did not involve the passing of a new congressional map. That did not happen. So it's still 7-1. That's going to be the map that's currently there, will be what everyone votes on in the fall. But they're also going to vote on this redistricting amendment to the state constitution. So if that does get approved, what's next?
Right. So some Democratic lawmakers said during special session debate that they actually hope Maryland never needs to draw an 8-0 map. They said it could depend on the outcome of the upcoming 2026 election. Right now, Republicans hold a majority in both the U.S. House and Senate. But history shows us at least one of those chambers is likely to flip in favor of the Democrats. It usually flips based on the opposite of the incumbent party. I asked House Majority Leader David Moon what criteria needs to be met for Maryland to decide not to redraw its map before the 2028 election. And he wouldn't explicitly say if Democrats taking back the majority in the U.S. House would cause Maryland to sit this one out. However, Ferguson said, quote, of course, when asked if how well Democrats do this upcoming election will determine if lawmakers will draw a new congressional map when Democrats return to Annapolis in January.
Of course. I think, you know, look, I'm hopeful to see, and I've said it over and over, that I would hope to see that we win 20 to 30 seats, you know, at a minimum. We should. We have winless wars that Trump has started.
Now, some of the breaking news from today that you've already reported on is that Republican lawmakers filed a lawsuit late last night against the governor and other top Democratic leaders over this particular amendment that was passed by the General Assembly this week. What are they arguing?
Yeah, so this really gets into the nitty-gritty of how a bill becomes a law in Maryland. So this past legislative session, lawmakers actually just passed a new law that essentially changes up the deadlines necessary for a ballot to be submitted on time and reach voters in November. So Democratic lawmakers had to attach an amendment to this constitutional amendment to exempt it from those deadlines. In theory, ballots must be submitted to the Secretary of State by July 1st. Obviously, that deadline could not be met because this special session was called later. But Republican lawmakers are arguing that it's not as simple as attaching an amendment, and that's a violation of the law because they violated those deadlines. They're also taking concern with Governor Wes Moore's decision to ceremoniously sign the constitutional amendment. That is not legally required. The governor does not have to be involved in legalizing constitutional amendments, and they're saying that this creates confusion for voters as trying to pass it off as a simple law instead of an amendment. So that case has now filed in state court. They're asking for an expedited review to try to block the ballot measure from even reaching the ballot this November.
And to check out more about that particular bill signing ceremony, Sarah did a report on that that came out or that went to our website yesterday. You can read that story and really does underscore again the fact that it was ceremonial. It didn't have to happen, but the governor wanted to do that. One reason that may stand out in particular is that, you know, the national media loves reporting on discord in the Democratic Party, whether real or imagined. It's pretty real here, though, in Maryland between Governor Moore and Senate President Ferguson. And some of this ceremony that may have taken place this week to sign this particular bill may have been in response to some of that. What was their relationship going into this and what coming out of this special session? How much does it affect what their relationship is?
Absolutely. Redistricting has really been a key part of the working relationship between the governor and Senate President Bill Ferguson the past year. The feud really started back in October when Ferguson released a slew of concerns explaining why he is opposed to early redistricting, because Maryland really is one of the only few blue states that has a clear path to try to redraw these maps. Mm-hmm. That's why other Democratic states have been scrambling to try and challenge these Republican-led efforts to get more congressional seats. But Governor Moore still went forward with putting together a redistricting advisory commission in November that recommended that 8-0 map to the General Assembly for passage. But as we discussed before, Ferguson continuously blocked a vote on that map, arguing the constitutional change had to happen first and that the timing wasn't right. Moore says he disagrees with this legal interpretation. And then that tension really peaked in May when Governor Moore did not endorse Ferguson in his Senate race, despite facing his toughest opponent yet. Ferguson did end up winning his race regardless, but there's clearly still some animosity between the two. But Governor Wes Moore had this to say when asked to characterize his relationship with President Ferguson at a press conference on Monday.
We had talked after 2022 about dealing with this issue ahead of 2030. And so this had been something that had been
I would say I have a very good relationship with the presiding officers and also all the members of the General Assembly. You know, this is hard stuff. Governance is hard. It means you're not always going to get what you want in the time you want. I understand that.
When Ferguson was asked if the governor can call the passage of this constitutional amendment as a win, he said, quote, "That's up to the commentators to decide."
And if you go again, read Sarah's story, looks into all that sort of stuff, all the coverage that she has done this week. It was fantastic. But again, just to recap this again, because as we know, it takes three times for people to hear something when you say this. No congressional map was passed this week. It was just a proposed amendment to the state constitution, which voters have to decide in the fall.
Yes, and if you vote yes to the ballot measure, you are essentially opening up the door for Maryland Democrats to draw a new map that could get rid of the one Republican seat, although they are arguing that that change may not be necessary. So just keep that in mind.
Stick around for all that as we get ready for our fall election coverage. Sarah's going to be a very big part in that, obviously, is the governor and all the statewide offices that are within state government, like attorney general and comptroller, are on the ballot, as are all seats in the General Assembly and county council and executive seats all across the state. Sarah, thank you so much. Go get some rest. You had a very, very long week.
Thank you, as always. Appreciate it.
Coming up next, Governor Moore also announced some major changes this week to Maryland's to the Preakness here in Maryland. We're going to hear from Childs Walker with our news partners, the Baltimore Banner, on that very complicated story that hit us this week that really needed some analysis. Then later we're going to talk about Frederick County data centers there. It was a citizen-led movement to get that before voters via a referendum, but it failed before the Maryland Supreme Court. Our reporter Nathaniel Miller is going to explain all of it to us as to why that happened. Coming up later here on the Friday News Roundup, I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us after this short break.
Support for WYPR comes from CFG Bank, headquartered in Baltimore. CFG Bank helps create solutions to help businesses succeed. More at cfg.bank. Member FDIC. And from listeners like you.
Your child's brain is celebrating its fifth podcast anniversary. That's 5 years, 60 episodes, and more than 95 experts who've shared insights on everything from autism to epilepsy to adaptive sports. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR. Check it out at WYPR.org, KennedyKrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I planted a soul food restaurant in the middle of a sea of pasta, meatballs, and pizza. I'm the eighth generation direct descendant to the first free black man to purchase property on Staten Island in Sandy Ground.
Join us for more true stories told live. Next time, finding home, photo finishing, and questioning faith. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Don't miss the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station, and proud partner with the nonprofit news site, the Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and the Banner are bringing local news you can trust to Maryland. Learn more at thebanner.com.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore and our region. I'm News Director Matt Bush. We're Riders up. The world of horse racing went through some major shakeups this week. On Monday, Churchill Downs announced a new Thoroughbred Championship Series that includes the Kentucky Derby and the Belmont Stakes. Two of the three members of the Triple Crown races in Maryland, or in horse racing, plus some other marquee races. But noticeably absent was the third member of the Triple Crown racing races, and that's the Preakness Stakes, based here in Maryland for over 150 years. Now, this announcement comes after Churchill Downs offered $85 million to buy the rights to the Preakness. The state of Maryland instead matched that offer, with Governor Westmore saying keeping the rights to the race were important to keep them in the state's hands. Now Maryland is implementing changes of its own, moving the Preakness to Memorial Day weekend. That's 3 weeks after the Derby instead of two, and will be held on a Sunday for the first time ever. Moore's administration this week also signed a six-year deal with NBC to make sure the race is aired on NBC through the year 2032. To help sort out what all of this means for the future of the Preakness, the racing industry, the Triple Crown, and Maryland's investment in it, we're joined by Childs Walker, who covers the Preakness and Maryland's thoroughbred racing industry for our news partner, the Baltimore Banner. Childs, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Matt. How are you?
Good. Well, it's been a busy week for you, and I think a lot of people, this was completely caught off guard, some of these this announcement of this new championship racing series, including a lot of people in Maryland's government. So let's try to wrap our heads around all of this. You know, the Preakness is a part of the Triple Crown, Maryland's investment in it. They now own Pimlico, and they're rebuilding it. How does this all this news fit together? Does the Preakness stay in the Triple Crown? What happens to the Triple Crown? I think there's a lot of interesting parts to go in here, but sort of what was the reaction immediately to this announcement?
Yeah, I mean, you did a good job of summarizing the two big happenings this week, Matt. You know, it certainly struck everyone. I mean, when Churchill Downs, which operates the Kentucky Derby and the New York Racing Association, announced this new series on Monday with a six race series, $5 million in payouts. Obviously the first thing that hit everyone in Maryland is, you know, hey, the Preakness isn't part of this. That's weird. The other two Triple Crown races are part of this. What is that saying about Maryland? And it does speak to the fact that Maryland and the Preakness have increasingly sort of become the odd man out in these big races. The Kentucky Derby is, you know, and Kentucky in general, probably the most powerful state in racing. New York, probably number two in terms of the money they put in, the prestige of the races. The Preakness had already been getting squeezed in recent years by the Triple Crown calendar. Obviously, the tradition is you run all three races in a five-week period, 2 weeks from the Derby to the Preakness, and then 3 weeks from the Preakness to the Belmont Stakes. But that is not a schedule that a lot of modern trainers are comfortable with. So we've seen more and more horses that run in the Derby, even the winners, have been skipping the Preakness in recent years. You know, the last two Kentucky Derby winners have not run in the Preakness and have gone on to win the Belmont Stakes, which has led a lot of people to say that the future of the Triple Crown is in serious doubt, and that the Preakness especially is losing prestige, that it's, you know, it's weakened event. And so to have this come out, you know, this new series that, you know, New York and Kentucky are using as a means to sort of promote their own big races and, you know, try to take racing into a new era. I mean, to see the Preakness not be a part of that, very alarming to people in Maryland, because it sort of continues an alarming trend that had already been happening with the signature race in the state. So, you know, that's prong one. And then, you know, obviously then prong two on Wednesday, you know, we have Governor Moore come back and say, well, our solution, at least to the Preakness, is, you know, we're going to move it back. We're not going to wait for New York to move theirs back. We're not going to wait for consensus. We're tired of that. We're going to create as much distance as we can between the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness in hopes that more trainers will bring their top Derby horses to Maryland, that they'll be more comfortable with a 22-day break as opposed to a 14-day break. So they're betting that will be the case. And, you know, Governor Moore said the Triple Crown still runs through Maryland. And that is true. I mean, the Triple Crown is still the Triple Crown. I mean, it's still, you know, the historic prestigious achievement in horse racing, but we've seen more and more in recent years that trainers do not feel beholden to going for it anymore, that it's maybe not the driving force in the sport they used to be. So the future is very much uncertain right now.
Now, New York Racing Association President David O'Rourke, who announced this new Thoroughbred Championship Series, says it builds on top of the Triple Crown rather than competing with it. Now, there is these arguments out there that this was also this announcement was retaliation because Maryland rejected Churchill Downs' bid to buy the Preakness's intellectual rights, and Maryland decided to keep it itself. This is what Governor Moore said about that this week.
I did not take it as any form of retaliation. But what I did take from it was it actually validated why we made the decision that we did to hold on to our IP and hold on to our own destiny.
So what do you think of this? Was it retaliation or not?
Yeah, I mean, it was not. I will say this. I'm not going to weigh in on that officially one or another, but I will tell you there were a lot of people I spoke to on Monday after this new series was announced who perceived vindictiveness in this move, you know, saw it as Churchill saying, okay, well, if you're not going to play ball with us, then we're just going to, you know, we're just going to create a whole new racing calendar without you. And, you know, you can enjoy the leftovers. I mean, you'll be the odd man out. A lot of people did read it that way, including a lot of people in Maryland. So, you know, whether that's the 100% truth or not, I don't know that it matters. I mean, that's, you know, this is all about perception and how these races are perceived. And that is the perception out there right now that, you know, basically neither Kentucky nor New York were sort of satisfied with where Maryland stood on things. And so they said, okay, well, we're the two more powerful entities. We'll team up and leave Maryland out in the cold. And, you know, that's kind of where we are right now.
All right, so the race next year is going to be run when it returns to Pimlico, as it's scheduled to do with Pimlico's $400 million renovations going on right now. It will be run Memorial Day weekend. It's also going to be run on Sunday. And again, one thing we do note, and you noted in your comments here, that it's now 3 weeks after the Kentucky Derby, but it's now only 2 weeks from the Belmont Stakes.
Yep.
So a couple different things there. One, how is that going to impact not just the television ratings, which are very important? Obviously, this television deal was announced with NBC this week. How might that impact the television ratings? How might that also impact the attendance of it here in Baltimore and in Maryland, because that is now a holiday weekend. Usually a lot of people on Memorial Day weekend thinking about the beach or many other things. So this date change, how does it affect things here locally?
Yeah, I think it's going to be fascinating to see how it turns out, because I think it's very much an open question. Now, in one sense, it does make a certain amount of sense to give, you know, the horsemen more time to, you know, sort of come back from the Derby. I think everyone gets that part of it. The other piece that's nice is that the Black Eyed Susan Stakes, which is the sort of the sister race to the Preakness, will now be on a Saturday and get a much nicer showcase on NBC. You know, we'll get its own bigger stage, and you know that's a nice thing for Maryland racing. I think probably people in this state have no idea how big the Kentucky Oaks, which is the sister race to the Derby, is. That run the day before the Derby. That's a huge event in Louisville, and I know there's always been a hope to have a day more like that here. So in those respects, you know, the move should help. In terms of the audience, though, I mean, it strikes me as quite the wide open question. I mean, you know, will it seem strange to people? You know, will I mean, people are so used to the calendar. You know, will you just sort of lose people to a lack of familiarity? Now, the Preakness actually did fairly well on television this year. The ratings were up, even though the Derby winner Golden Tempo was not in the race. So, coming off actually a decent number in that respect. On the other hand, it was at Laurel Park with a very small crowd. So, you know, in terms of what the live event, it's going to be another wild card this year, because though it is going to be back at Pimlico, it's not going to be full on Pimlico with a grandstand. It's going to be the track and probably a lot of temporary stands. So it's going to be a sort of an interesting, you know, one-off event one way or another. So now you have this date change added to it. It's just going to be a fascinating year to sort of see what we get. I mean, I don't know right now, and I don't think anybody knows. But look, things weren't going great for the Preakness overall, so you can't blame Maryland for, you know, taking a stab at you know, doing something better and sort of forcing the hands of the other states.
I guess, and the last question here is just for people who are maybe unfamiliar with horse racing, but you keep mentioning that, you know, the Kentucky Derby winner hasn't come to the Preakness the last 2 years because it's only a 2 week gap. This will now make it a 3 week gap between those two races. What's been the change, I guess, in horse trainers of not wanting horses to run 2 weeks to 3 weeks? What's kind of been the mindset? What's been the decisions that have really changed that? Because that seems to have really one of the bigger impacts on the Preakness.
It has. It's changed everything. And this is a trend that we've been seeing for really more than a decade now. Sort of the newer generation of top trainers, you know, the old school guys, you know, the Bob Befferts of the world didn't have problem, you know, coming back on 2 weeks. Bob Beffert still doesn't. But you know, kind of the generation behind him, for whatever reason, they're just more comfortable with a 4 or 5 week break between races for their extremely valuable horses. I mean, that's what you have to remember, is that these horses are tremendous assets beyond what they do on the track. They generate probably more revenue as breeding properties than they do as racehorses at this point. So there's a lot of effort to protect them as best as possible. And that has led to more caution in terms of, you know, how frequently they race. You know, often they're retired at the end of their 3-year-old season or their 4-year-old season. You know, they don't race as long into life as they used to. I mean, we just see a lot more cautious handling of these very valuable horses. And that has made it much harder for the Preakness to book marquee fields. And it's going to continue to be an issue because even though the Preakness is now 22 days after the Derby, with the Belmont Stakes now only 13 days after the Preakness, trainers are still going to be left with the dilemma of, you know, which one do I choose? You know, the overall problem of I don't want to race my horse 3 times in 5 weeks still exists. And until we sort of see more cooperation between Maryland and New York, that's going to be the big dilemma for the Triple Crown.
Childs Walker covers the Maryland horse racing industry, the Preakness, and all those things for our news partners, the Baltimore Banner. Childs, thanks for coming on here and trying to help us understand these rather jarring news.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Matt.
Coming up, a data center standoff in Frederick County made it all the way to the Maryland Supreme Court after voters trying to weigh in with a referendum. Then we hear from a Baltimore writer on the power of reading in an excerpt from WYPR's Pass the Mic. That's all coming up next on the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us.
Practical Parenting, a podcast produced by GBMC, helps empower parents in the trenches and find joy in the magical mess of summer. The sun is out and so are the schedules. But don't worry, we have your back. New episodes drop every other Friday. Tune in to get all the resources, support, and confidence you need to thrive through the chaos. Practical Parenting, available on WYPR.org, the mobile app, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Your Child's Brain is celebrating its 5th podcast anniversary. That's 5 years, 60 episodes, and more than 95 experts who've shared insights on everything from autism to epilepsy to adaptive sports. Your Child's Brain is produced by Kennedy Krieger Institute with assistance from WYPR. Check it out at WYPR.org, KennedyKrieger.org/YCB, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Were you a nosy kid?
Are you kidding me? Of course I was. Questions for everybody.
Somebody who liked to ask questions all the time?
Yeah. Annoyingly so, I think some people would say. But
well,
yeah.
I mean,
maybe
I
today
think,
they would say that.
I think a lot of us were. And you know what else? I think a lot of other people are.
Stay nosy. Stay curious. With Morning Edition.
Morning Edition.
Every weekday
Monday
morning on NPR
Friday,
News.
Beginning at 5 a.m. here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
And welcome back to WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR News Team. Data centers, they're going to be a big issue in this fall's elections, not just in Maryland, but all across the country. But in one Maryland county, they won't explicitly be on the ballot. But it's going to show up in other races, no doubt. To explain that riddle, we have one of our reporters, WYPR's Frederick County journalist, Nathaniel Miller. He's joining us here in studio. Nathaniel, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we dive into the failed referendum effort in Frederick, we need to remind everyone what the issue was to begin with. The county council approved an expanded area for data centers in the county that was larger than what was recommended by the county planning commission. What were the reasons for that, and what was the reaction to it?
So the area itself is known as the Critical Digital Infrastructure Overlay Zone, but whenever you hear that, think data centers. Now, it was 2,600 acres, and at full build-out, a study by HR&A advisors estimates it could generate around $215 million in revenue annually. That's about one-fifth of the county's current budget. Now, before the overlay zone, data centers could actually be built on any of Frederick County's 5,000 acres of industrial land, so the zone did cut that down by nearly half. However, there were a lot of frustrations among residents. The overlay zone overlaps Quantum Frederick, which is Frederick County's current data center campus, and it's 1,600 acres. That's notably smaller. Quantum Frederick is not fully built yet, so a lot of residents asked why make a bigger zone around it. Also, the overlay zone includes more than 1,000 acres of prime farmland and land that could have been put into preservation. Elizabeth Bauer has spoken in front of the Frederick County Council for years and voiced her frustrations.
So Bauer is part of a group that sought to get this matter before Frederick County voters via a referendum on the November ballot. Who was this group and what were they doing?
So this group is known as the Frederick County Data Center Referendum Committee, and what they wanted was to put the decision of whether to keep the overlay zone or not in the hands of residents themselves. All through the public process, across months of the county asking residents what they wanted, people kept saying no, but this happened anyways, and many ended up feeling unheard. Now, what the committee chose to do was to address the referendum, the ordinance that made the overlay zone, not the bill that created the rules for how to create the overlay zone.
So while they succeeded in getting all their necessary signatures, that was not enough when the matter got to the Supreme Court of Maryland, who decided whether this was going to be on the ballot. What did the court rule?
So ultimately, the Supreme Court agreed with an earlier circuit court decision. The actual piece of paper, the petition itself, was too unclear for those signing it to make an informed decision. Now, this came down to two questions. Firstly, ordinances versus laws. What the court found was that an ordinance under the Frederick County Charter did not qualify as a law that was subject to referendum to begin with. The second question was a matter of clarity for the petition itself, and this came down to color and font size. The committee had to follow both state and county regulations, which required them to fit the full text on the back of each petition page. Now, they shrunk the font to save space, and they printed in black and white instead of the 10 original colors, which was considered the fatal flaw for this petition.
So you did a fantastic story that analyzes all of this. It'll be in the show notes, and it's at our website, WYPR.org, that looked at the things like you just said, like font sizes and whether it was printed in color, plus whether this was something that could be subjected to a referendum. So again, what were the rules that the court outlined in its ruling that could impact any future referendums that happen in Frederick County?
So local referendums are subject to state regulations first and foremost, but local governments can set additional rules that are more strict. Now, at the state level, the right to referendum is set within the state's constitution. Any act or part of an act of the General Assembly is subject to referendum. There are exceptions, such as for things pertaining to the maintenance of the state government or public institutions. This ensures funding for schools and hospitals doesn't just up and disappear one day. Now, to get a successful state referendum, you need 3% of Maryland voters to sign. Each page of the petition must include the full text being referred or an approved summarization. Now, how's Frederick any different? Once again, any bill or part of a bill is subject to referendum with a few additional exceptions. Taxes, funds to maintain the government, and laws establishing council districts are exempt. Now, Frederick requires 7% of voters, or roughly 15,000 signatures, and that's due within 59 days of a bill being enacted. Now, enactment and signing of a bill can be different dates.
So what's the future now? Data centers are not going to explicitly be on the ballot in Frederick County in November, but they're going to show up. It's going to be a huge issue in the races that are going to be on the ballot, like county executive, county council, and the county's delegation to the General Assembly. So where's data centers? Where will they fit into those local and state races that are going to be decided in Frederick?
So most new county executive and county council candidates ran on either an explicitly anti or critical data center platform. Many residents are not happy with the current officials and are critical of incumbent Democrat Frederick County Executive Jessica Fitzwater and how she's handled data centers so far. Residents are worried that some of her recent data center critical actions, such as an executive order that froze any future data center considerations until after a state impact study, is just an effort to try and save her reelection. Now, two Republican candidates ran in a primary for executive office against her. Former City of Frederick Mayor Jeff Holtzinger, who ultimately won, and former County Director of Procurement Diane Fouché. Both want to see data centers reined in and handled much more carefully with a focus on the environment.
Nathaniel Miller is WYPR's Frederick County journalist. We're here talking about data centers and how they will and won't be on the ballot in November. He's going to keep reporting on all that. Check out his reporting right now at our website, WYPR.org. Nathaniel, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to pass the mic to a Baltimore writer who shares the importance of reading. And then we'll talk about BTS's upcoming concert here in Baltimore. This is WYPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us after this break.
Maryland. Maryland Unfolded is a history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. In our latest episode, we visit the Pride of Baltimore II, a reproduction of a 19th century Baltimore Clipper, and explore Maryland's maritime heritage with the ship's captains and crew. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible in part by Gallagher LLP.
Boythrob is an unconventional boy band, partly because one member has never physically met his bandmates.
We need 1 million followers for me to get a visa so I can sing and dance in America.
After almost a year of campaigning on social media, Boythrob is bringing its fourth member to the U.S. I'm Ilse Chang, the band's quest for a visa on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station and a media partner for the Baltimore Speaker Series presented by Stevenson University. One subscription, seven live events at the Meyerhoff, including former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, and former NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. The Baltimore Speaker Series presenting the world up close. BaltimoreSpeakers.org made possible in part by Cremon and Graham.
Welcome back to WIPR's Friday News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. Bree Reed is a Baltimore-based writer and regular contributor to the Baltimore Beat, and you can catch her at many city bookstores, literary panels, and events. But for a bookworm like her, reading did not always come naturally.
Pass the Mic is made possible by a grant from the T. Rowe Price Foundation, recognizing 45 years of advancing thriving communities and building financial well-being. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not reflect the views of the T. Rowe Price Foundation, T. Rowe Price, or any of their subsidiaries or affiliates.
Pass the mic.
Hand that to me.
Pass it over here.
Pass the mic.
Pass the Mic is the community-driven radio show that gives you the space to share your stories, issues, and concerns your way. Today, we pass the mic to writer Bree Reed, who talks about the link between reading and community empowerment.
I'm always going to be a reader first, no matter how far my writing takes me. My name is Bree Reed. I'm a Baltimore-born and bred reader, educator, writer, and lover of the arts. I realized how deeply reading mattered to me when I was in kindergarten. We were learning through sight words, and I was really struggling with reading the sight word read. My kindergarten teacher, in her moment of frustration, was like, "It's literally your last name." I walked home to my mom, crestfallen, and that's when we made the decision that, like, reading was going to be something that we worked on and built up together. From there, you could not keep me out of a library. My mom would have her little, I think people usually use them in New York for laundry carts, dolly trolleys, and we would go shopping, put our groceries in there, and on the way back, we would stop down to our local Eni Pratt Library branch. My mom flipped the script on bedtime reading. A lot of people talk about the books they read to their children, but my mom, in an effort to increase my literacy and my confidence in reading, I read to her every night. It started to get me more and more excited as I was going from reading those picture books to reading full chapter books to her as she's falling asleep after a hard day of working. And ever since then, reading has been a solace, a refuge, and a world changer. I've learned so much about the world around me from being an avid reader. When it comes to how I got into book and literary criticism, Lawrence Birney, who I had the pleasure to interview and talk to about his book No Sense in Wishing, we spoke about how criticism is a part of Baltimore Black family life in a lot of ways. We're not shy about being assertive in our opinions, and I think the other part of it is going to schools that were so deeply committed to empowering young people to have strong opinions and to state them plainly. I'll never forget, I attended Baltimore City College at a time when the Baltimore Uprising happened.
Dozens of protesters gathered in front of City Hall.
No, I remember being on the last bus out of Mondawmin that day.
The Mondawmin Mall, shot to fame as the place where the Baltimore riot began.
We need justice down here. We need peace. No justice! But when I think about living through the uprising, I think about how much it taught me about community and liberation. Goes back to the liberation of children. And if we have plans for the future and we are not planning to include children in them, our plans are incomplete. when I talk about my deep love for Baltimore City College. It's my deep love for adults who, at a time when I think infantilizing children, particularly Black children, is the easy answer, they chose to lean into understanding that Black children are capable. I'm not even 30, and I think looking at the rich literary life I've already gotten to live, I feel so blessed, and it reminds me that there's so much left to do.
Pass the Mic is produced by Elizabeth Nonamaker, Mallory Pinkard-Pierre, and Amy Walters. Tune in Tuesday, August 11th at 7:30 p.m. to hear Bree Reed host her own episode of Pass the Mic. This is a presentation of Baltimore Public Media.
Again, that's on Tuesday, August 11th at 7:30 p.m. here on WIPR. Bree Reed will host her own episode of Pass the Mic, asking two principals of Baltimore City College why they value public education. And if you want to hear more from Pass the Mic, we're here to help. We're excited to bring you more stories, more guest hosts, and more conversations more often. Beginning September 1st, tune in to Pass the Mic every Tuesday evening at 7:30 here on WIPR. In the meantime, you can visit WIPR.org, our website, and listen and subscribe to Pass the Mic wherever you get podcasts. Up next, where will your high schooler be on Monday and Tuesday? They may be at the BTS show. The global sensation will be on stage at M&T Bank Stadium. Maybe not everyone is excited about it, though. Keep listening after the break to find out why. This is WIPR's News Roundup, and I'm Matt Bush. Stay with us.
What do we want?
Affordable fun.
When do we want it?
How about September 13th?
Perfect. That's when Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair. Your ticket includes admission to the fair, and kids under six are free for Pop Princesses with Enslow and her band, performing hits by Taylor, Olivia, Sabrina, and more, plus a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both. Details at WTMD.org.
Hi there, I'm David Ballou, the Director of Development at Baltimore Public Media. The summer brings the heat and everything with it, but it also reminds us at WIPR that our listeners continue to support local stories, art, and journalism. Thank you to everyone who donated before our fiscal year ended in June. It's your dedication to fact-based journalism that allows us to thrive this summer. As we enter the second half of the summer, I hope you continue to stay curious and inspired when tuning into WIPR. Thank you for being a part of the history of local public radio in Maryland. It's never too late to become a member of the WIPR family. You can make a gift easily now by visiting WIPR.org.
Boy Throb is an unconventional boy band. One member has not been able to physically join his bandmates in the U.S. The very online boy band's campaign for a visa. On all things considered,
from today at 4 on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. A lot going on for those looking for something to do. Baltimore Fashion Week kicks off, so look out for those events. And the Crow's Nest is hosting live jazz and poetry as part of the Black August from Harlem to Havana opening reception. There's some sad news, though, for the artistic community this week. The Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance is closing shop. It's a funding source for regional artists. But for those looking to shake the blues and celebrate what's left of summer, the global sensation and Korean pop group BTS will be stopping in Baltimore as part of their long-awaited reunion tour.
I did not expect them to come to my home state, which made me really, like, shocked and also excited at the same time.
Abby Wagner is from California, Maryland, and runs the K-pop in D.C. Instagram and has been anxiously awaiting the group's return since their last world tour wrapped up in 2019. Fresh from serving South Korea's mandatory military service, the band has a brand new album, Are We Wrong, and a new hit. The song is titled Normal, but BTS's massive fan base, known as the BTS Army, is anything but.
I got tickets for both days, and now I'm really excited to go to both days.
Abby's not alone. The boy band grossed over $125 million in ticket sales, the highest monthly gross ever. And there's some power in those numbers. In 2020, fans coordinated to reserve tickets to a President Trump rally in Tulsa with no plans to show up, leaving the arena half empty. When BTS donated $1 million to Black Lives Matter the same year, their fans matched the donation within a day. And ahead of the coming Baltimore shows, the BTS Army cleaned up the area around M&T Bank Stadium and donated cupcake proceeds to a local community group helping kids with academics. Beat the streets. Get it? BTS. Read more about that from our friends, the Baltimore Banner. They did a great story on that. But for some fans, even big fans, their relationship with the pop idols has been tested.
I criticize what I love. I think it's important to talk about what goes wrong just as much as it is important to talk about what goes right.
Stitch, a culture writer and former Teen Vogue contributor, is the author of the widely read 2019 essay series, Cultural Appropriation in the Age of K-Pop.
Cultural appropriation is a performance. That's what it is. It's a performance of another culture's culture, or what it is seen to be. So for Black people, it's not always positive. It's the stereotypes about what it means to be a Black person.
Her writing was part of a conversation happening at the time 7 years ago, and now that BTS is back here in Baltimore, we wanted to see what's changed. We're now joined by journalist and cultural and culture critic Stitch. She uses the alias Stitch in response to serious online harassment and threats. Stitch, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm so excited. Thank you.
Great. Well, as a longtime BTS fan, what do you think of their new album, Are We Wrong, and their latest song?
So it's actually back on my regular rotation, my office playlist, starting like Monday. I was like, something made me go, maybe I should listen to them again. Cause like normally I've been listening to musicals, but something made me go, okay, well, let me like go back into this. And I really do like many of the songs on Arirang. Body to Body, Aliens 2.0 and Normal really stand out to me as signs that BTS have really well and truly grown up. And are, you know, just bigger than they were before.
So for those of you, for those who may not have read your article in 2019 or the larger conversation around it, define cultural appropriation here, how you defined it in that, and how you've seen it manifest in K-pop and even with a group like BTS.
Sure. So for me, cultural appropriation can be defined as something that isn't a conversation or collaboration between cultures. It's cosplay, it's costuming, it's what you think a culture does or is like and wearing that. And in K-pop broadly, it's in the adopting of a Black scent, talking the way you think Black people talk like. When you're talking about South Asian performances, it's putting a bindi on, mimicking Black hairstyles and Black dress. And we saw this back in 2013 with BTS pre-debut and early debut, specifically the No More Dream music video, where the members were dressed in ways that approximated what they believed hip hop or Black style was, including hairstyles. Like RM had like a little fade fuzzy afro going on. Then around the time that I did my essay, actually, if you look at the, I think the header image, there may be a picture of J-Hope. I don't know if that was before or after he did the chicken noodle soup collaboration with Becky G. In that performance, he had his hair in gel twists, and it sparked a really huge conversation among ARMY at the time about what it meant to see BTS, who we had at that time been like, oh, well, they've grown, they've leveled up, kind of show that they weren't 100% of the way there.
There's also a complicated history of K-pop that involves the U.S. military in Korea. I want to play a clip from an episode of From LA's show California Love that gets into that, and it centers around this nightclub in Seoul.
And this club was home to a ton of other future K-pop legends, people who would go on to become architects and shapers of 90s K-pop. But here's the thing about this nightclub. It wasn't meant for Koreans. It was actually a spot for Black American GIs who were stationed in Seoul. And Korean locals just wound up going there.
We highly recommend everybody listening to that episode as NPR's Code Switch also aired it. We'll link to it on our website and in the show notes for this show. Suffice to say, the history is complicated, and when your article came out, you took issue with a related argument that came up that Korean artists can't be expected to understand anti-Blackness because they're isolated from Black culture. Lots of layers here. Where do you see this conversation now?
Talk like this. When Kiss of Life, a girl group, a very relatively new girl group, did an act of cultural appropriation that was just outright insulting towards Black people, the conversation was, oh, well, they don't know any better. And I find that to be incredibly infantilizing. It doesn't speak to the current culture. We're all incredibly connected online. And now more than ever, idols have relationships with Black professionals, celebrities, and fans. Many of them read or speak English, or we read and speak Korean at increasing rates. And while I do place like the lion's share of blame on careless companies, I think it's really inappropriate to deny these idols the agency behind their own actions. Like with Kiss of Life, they chose to perform a caricature of Blackness. They chose that, not the company. And I think at a point where idols are also trying to be global, it's not just companies, it's idols trying to be more in tune with everyone. I think they need to understand that, you know, you can love Black culture, Black American culture, collaborate with us, perform music that speaks to you without performing us literally.
This obviously is a new era for BTS, first tour in several years after they did their mandatory Korean military service. How much do you think they've changed since that last time?
I think they've changed a lot. So I've been aware of BTS since about 2016, 2017, and I would identify as an ARMY since 2019, like actively traveling to partake in fandom. And I would say that the BTS of 2026 is not the BTS of 2019, and they're not the BTS of 2013. Like, I believe I've seen a lot of growth. And while they got some side eye for their marketing for Arirang with Howard University, I believe, I think that BTS is very aware of their socio-political influence and the role that Black fans have played in their growth, in their reception, and in how they're able to create and collaborate. So one thing I really, really love about BTS as I've been listening to them is that once they're made aware of an issue, you don't see that repeated. Like once they're told, we're good, usually, you know, and it happens that that's not always the case with celebrities. And it's really good to see that there is a constant evolution of artistry, of personhood, of awareness from BTS going across these years.
Now, one thing just to mention, you've been thinking much about this, how their sort of rejection of labeling and tokenization. They made the decision to boycott the Grammys after the introduction of the Best Asian Pop Music Performance category. How much have you been thinking about that?
So I'm always thinking about this, actually, because I am very interested in the history of hip hop and R&B in the United States and global hip hop, period. And so when Bad Bunny, you know, cleared everything, everybody was talking about him, and we got like a reggaeton focused category, a lot of people from then said, well, BTS will be next. There will be some really highly technical Asian music category. And now there is. And it is a clear response, what BTS has done. It's a clear response to what the Grammys has always done. Categories of genres popularized by minorities, by people of color, are often shunted off to the side, whether it's moved out of the main show, like the main 2-hour show at primetime, or moved out of the ability to access the bigger categories. And I know that this...
We're unfortunately going to have to leave it there, Stitch. That you're running out of time here in the show. But thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. Stitch is a culture critic and author of Cultural Appropriation in the Age of K-Pop.
Thank you.
BTS is playing M&T Bank Stadium Monday and Tuesday. We're going to be back next Friday here with the WYPR News Roundup. We do want to say one thank you, though, to Isaac Moss, our Anthony Brandon fellow, who's been working on the show this summer. This is Isaac's last show working on the News Roundup. Isaac was critical as we built the voice of the show and what it was going to be. Isaac, your contributions to the News Roundup will stay here whether you are on the show or not, because you have always brought in good conversations and topics for us to have on the show. Isaac, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week here on the WYPR News Roundup.